We are talking with Herbert Mitgang about his book Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors. Mr. Mitgang is a cultural correspondent of the New York Times. He is, in addition to this book, the author of 4 novels, 4 biographies, 10 other nonfiction works, and a play about the life of Abraham Lincoln. He is also a 2-time winner of the American Bar Association's Silver Gavel Award for legal writing. The book is just recently published by Donald Fine. And as we talk, if you would like to be involved in our discussion, you'd like to speak with our guest, please don't hesitate to pick up the phone and give us a call. Mr. Mitgang, hello.
Hello.
Very interesting book. I enjoyed reading it. I'm glad you could be with us today. I mentioned, just so people will have had some idea, the range of people that the FBI was keeping tabs on. If you look at them, their lives, what they wrote about, their work, they all seem to be very different. What do these people have in common, or do they have anything in common?
Well, one thing they have in common, I discovered, was an FBI dossier. But why did they have dossiers? Well, historically, it's part of the Cold War, which goes back not to Fulton, Missouri, in the speech by Churchill in 1946, but goes back to the First World War, the end of it, and the beginnings of Bolshevism, and they thought that particularly J. Edgar Hoover and the Attorney General of the United States were afraid that radicals were going to anarchists and Bolsheviks were going to take over the United States. And that was the true beginning of the Cold War and the invasion of privacy and domestic surveillance. More specifically, why many of these authors and artists had files was that there were two benchmarks. One in the 1920s was the Sacco-Vanzetti case, where many people thought that these two anarchists had been railroaded and didn't get a fair trial and justice and certainly should not have been executed by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And then another one that involved people like Dos Passos and Hemingway and Dorothy Parker and Lillian Hellman, many of the great authors in the United States and playwrights, was the Spanish Civil War. These people were on the loyalist side against fascist and Franco Spain. One might say they were prematurely anti-fascist in that famous phrase, because soon thereafter, Franco Spain was the enemy of the United States in World War II.
It seems that, of course, another thing that these people had in common, many of them, was that they had aroused the attention, the suspicion of J. Edgar Hoover, the man who for so many years headed the FBI. Was this effort at keeping tabs on these people largely the exclusive effort or idea or brainchild of Hoover?
No, it was not, because after all, there were presidents like Harry Truman who started loyalty oaths back there during his presidency. Hoover can't take full credit for being the ultimate Cold Warrior. There was a fellow named McCarthy. There was the Senate Internal Security Committee, the House Un-American Activities Committee, which went after Hollywood writers and directors, the movie studios themselves. A lot of people, some trade unions caved in, and there were the country was divided during the Cold War on with an enormous fear of socialism or radicalism coming to this country. Of course, there was no glasnost then, and there was it was used for political reasons by many people to advance their own cause, including Richard Nixon. After all, he was chosen because he was considered such a hardliner, and against Reds, and everyone was looking for Reds under the beds. Of course, nobody, even though there were enormous millions of dollars spent, by the House Un-American Activities Committee, and then there was a California Un-American Activities Committee, which was even worse. Nobody could ever point to a single Hollywood movie that was made in which a Marxist line was ever advocated.
In fact, I think you make the point in the book, and you make it in several places, that none of these people were ever convicted of any crimes, certainly none of the offenses for which they were being investigated, maybe never any crimes at all.
That's right. They were accused of very serious crimes, including subversion, even espionage. But out of the 100 people or so who were mentioned in the book, artists and dramas and authors, and not one of them ever was indicted, not one of them ever spent a day in jail.
What was your entry point into this story? How did you get involved in it?
Well, there was a man from the state of Illinois named Carl Sandburg.
Mm-hmm.
Galesburg, Illinois. Lombard College, now Knox College. I edited Carl Sandburg's letters. And in fact, I once took a walk with Sandburg through the University of Illinois Library. And when I edited his letters, among the early letters was the fact that the Secret Service and the United States Army had confiscated his papers when he came back from Sweden, being a correspondent for Newspaper Enterprise Association. And they were keeping files on him. So under the Freedom of Information Act, that wonderful law that was passed in the wake of Watergate, I wrote away for Carl Sandburg's file. And sure enough, Carl Sandburg had a dossier. The interesting thing is, it wasn't just from that post-World War One period, but once you got into a file, the FBI wouldn't let you get out, and they kept tracking him right until he was in his 80s and living in retirement down in his wife's goat farm in Flat Rock, North Carolina. The FBI was still chasing this old man for his writings.
And one of the things that you talk about in this case and apparently in other cases was that much of the information that, or a good part of the information that was in these files was wrong, that they were full of errors. Can you give some examples?
Yes. I'll give you a little minor one which talks about, shows the inaccuracy, naivete, Tennessee Williams had a file there in which a streetcar named Desire was described as a novel, not a play. But more seriously, John Steinbeck, Nobel laureate, had file, and the FBI, which apparently had some amateur literary critics in it, found that his great novel, The Grapes of Wrath, was a socialistic document. Well, it was later made into the film by starring Henry Fonda, and The Grapes of Wrath undoubtedly had some influence in causing legislation to help the migratory workers during the Depression. This seminal American novel, sympathetic to the impoverished and the Okies, was considered a subversive document in some way, so that later on, when John Steinbeck tried to enlist in the army, help the war cause, his FBI file tracked and trailed him, and he couldn't get into the service. Ironically, at the same time, John Steinbeck was a friend of President Roosevelt, contributed to his speeches. But even though he could help the commander-in-chief, they wouldn't let him become a second lieutenant because of J. Edgar Hoover's file on him.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, Mr. Hoover didn't have much use for Mr. Roosevelt. You mentioned in the book at some point that Hoover thought that the New Deal was a communist plot.
That's right. If the New Deal was a communist plot, then so was Social Security. So was the regulatory agencies.
You suggest there that one interesting fact that you see when you look at the book is that it appears that the FBI people didn't really pay very careful attention to the work of the people that they were following, that they didn't quite. They obviously, many of these things they hadn't read. I think in some cases the reason that people got on the FBI's list of suspicious persons was simply because, for example, you mentioned Tennessee Williams. Apparently one of the reasons he was on the list was because the communist paper, Daily Worker, gave a good review to Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah.
So somehow, if the communists thought that the work of the person was good, then that somehow must mean that there was something wrong with them.
Sure. And Tennessee Williams, who was also considered a suspect because he was a known homosexual. And the FBI disapproved anything that wasn't a straight arrow in their view. And, of course, the FBI was very interested in sex.
Mm.
And we know that they kept files on Martin Luther King, tried to frame him. They also kept files on every president in his family and every congressman and senator. And this was a way of blackmailing, or even more specifically, of increasing the FBI budgets and making sure that the congressmen were on their side.
Yeah. Well, we're talking this morning with Herbert Mittgang. He is the author of a recent book, Dangerous Dossiers, that tells the story of years of FBI surveillance of some of America's greatest authors. And as always, you're invited to call in if you have your own questions, that is, you folks who are listening. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free in Illinois, it's 800-222-9455. In some of these cases, I think that that some of these people were almost amused by the fact that the FBI was keeping tabs on them. You did, though, mention one case with Steinbeck,
yes.
That information was really used against him.
Yes.
Are there many cases where the information that was in these files really was an inconvenience or worse, or was it in a sense just on the level of a nuisance?
Yeah. Well, most of the people did not know that they had FBI files because they were accused by faceless accusers. And these are raw files. The Steinbeck wrote to the Attorney General, "Will you get J. Edgar Hoover's boys off my heels?" He knew he had a file. Ernest Hemingway had a strong suspicion that he had a file, so when he registered at the hospital and didn't want to be bothered, he had registered on the different name, but fearing the FBI might cause some trouble, the FBI was informed that he had a different name when he registered there. There were, especially in cases of military service, there were several writers who, while in the Army, had their FBI dossiers trailing them. Irwin Shaw was one example. Nelson Algren was another example. Dashiell Hammett was another example. All three were in uniform, they would, whenever they were recommended for a promotion or something, it was killed. Irwin Shaw, for example, author of The Young Lions, Rich Man, Poor Man, tried to get into my old army outfit, Stars and Stripes, in Algiers. and we wondered why he was not allowed to join our newspaper. And it was only after I got his FBI file that I discovered that J. Edgar Hoover personally had a letter in Irwin Shaw's file was considering him a possible communist while he's in uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the same with Dashiell Hammett. Dashiell Hammett, up there in the Aleutians, Corporal Dashiell Hammett, who enlisted at age 48, he had also served in World War One. He was being trailed by the FBI. The one particular case I give in the book, incidentally, none of these files prevented these writers from doing their thing. The book business is quite different from the Hollywood business, where the Hollywood 10 actually went to jail for not answering, responding before committees to questions or taking the Fifth Amendment or the First Amendment of the Constitution. But in the case of authors, none of this prevented them from having their say in writing their books. In Hollywood and as well as in television, blacklisting was the order of the day, and not just during the McCarthy era. It extended for a good 10 years afterwards.
Yeah. Well, I have a caller holding on here. I hope that we will get some other people involved in the show. Our telephone number, 333-9455, toll-free in Illinois, 800-222-9455. We're talking with Herbert Mitgang, author of Dangerous Dossiers. Here's our first caller here on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Mitgang, I would like to ask you if going through your research on the files on the Hollywood screenwriters at the time, if in those notes you ever found any reference to the people who fingered some of those men. For instance, our present president was said to have been, I don't know whether he was the head of the Screen Actors Guild at the time or just a member, but that he often performed the duties of an informer. I wondered if you ever found any reference to that.
You're absolutely right, ma'am. And I include that in my book. In 1947, Ronald Reagan was president of the Screen Actors Guild. He and his then wife, Jane Wyman, his first wife, were both spying on their fellow actors in the Screen Actors Guild. And they were such good informers that they were assigned code names by the FBI. Jane Wyman was called Agent T9, T as in Tom. Ronald Reagan, president of the Screen Actors Guild, was Agent T10. And at the same time that they were elected by their fellow actors, they were also surreptitiously behind the backs of those who attended meetings. They were also serving as informers for the FBI. Now, I did not discover this myself, although I did obtain the file. This story first appeared in a California newspaper, the San Jose Mercury News. Very ingeniously wrote away for this material and obtained it. And I also afterwards did so in order to see the actual documents, and I have the documents describing this, so there's no question about it. Interestingly enough, a couple of months ago, in the wake of the Iran Contra hearings, President Reagan of the United States, not of the Screen Actors Guild, spoke nostalgically of the good old days of the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Yeah. Does that get at your question, or would you like to follow
That's
up?
That's fine.
On that?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. How long did it take you to accumulate all of this material and to go through it?
Well, it took me about 4 years, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, and by the way, the FBI records division was very cooperative in this respect. Of course, they were upholding the law, the Freedom of Information Act. Nevertheless, they cooperated in sending me these Xeroxes and photocopies of these files on various. Of course, the files themselves, in many, if not most cases, were censored. There was blacked out lines which they put in, and sometimes I appealed their decision to do so and got a little more information. But even though the material was censored by the FBI, especially when it came to giving out the names of informants, I did patiently wait. In some cases it would be 6 months. In some cases it was more than 2 years before they sent me the material.
Yeah, you have in the book reproduced a few pages here and there, and some of them look as if there was the censorship was so heavy it's a wonder that you can get anything out of them at all.
Yes, they're like the Thomas Wolfe file was so blacked out that it was almost impossible. But then you saw about 25 pages, and then after looking at thousands and thousands of pages. And also going to biographies and their own writings and the newspaper reports, you could fill in the blanks and find out what was going on, where they were at particular times. Thomas Wolfe, of course, had gone to Nazi Germany, which before World War II, and he was being followed there. Or take the case of Alexander Calder, the great artist, sculptor, inventor of the mobile and Stabile. His file was censored, much to my surprise that he even had a file, but Alexander Calder participated in anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, both in Paris and in Washington, and even though the file was censored, it was well known he was out front against America's participation and escalation of the Vietnam War. So even though the files were blacked out, one could piece together the true stories.
This morning on Focus 580, our guest is Herbert Mittgang, and we're talking with him about his new book, Dangerous Dossiers. It tells the story of years of FBI surveillance of some of America's greatest writers. And just to mention a few, we're talking about people like Pearl S. Buck, William Faulkner, Sinclair Lewis, Thomas Wolfe, Dorothy Parker, Truman Capote, Dashiell Hammett, William Saroyan, Robert Lowell, H.L. Mencken, also foreign authors, Graham Greene, Aldous Huxley, and artists like Alexander Calder and Georgia O'Keeffe. They are all detailed in this book. It's newly published by Donald Fine. And if you would like to get in on our discussion, the number is 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free in Illinois, it's 800-222-9455. We do have another caller here. Why don't we talk with them here on our toll free line? Hello.
Hello. Oh,
yes.
I wrote a letter. Perhaps you remember how long ago it was, about a year or so, to the Chad Embassy when Libya and Chad were having a border dispute, and Libyan troops were occupying Aouzi, which is just south of the border on the maps that we commonly see. And I sent it to Embassy Park Drive. I didn't know the exact address. All of those letters to foreign embassies are handled by a separate special department at the post office. The letter contained an article that I cut out of the Chicago Tribune that indicated that this territory just might be Libyan territory. The letter came back, address C unknown, and probably you've gotten letters back like this. The address was lined out, and a new address, 2600 Virginia Avenue, was written in pen next to it. So I sent the letter off to 2600 Virginia Avenue, and that one came back undeliverable. And I know that the post office must know where the Chad Embassy to the United States is, even if it's in a separate room in the Chadian ambassador's apartment. So I sent it to a friend of mine who's a Mozambican agent instead, and he never got it. So I sent my friend's father a get-well card following, and he never got that. So now when I send letters to places like the Institute for International Communications in Kiev, I also send copies to Senator Simon. I don't know if they get those or not, or even if Senator Simon gets them. I'm wondering if I should be concerned about my own welfare.
In what respect?
I wonder if the FBI is opening my mail.
Well, you can write away to them and try. You see, there is a distinction between the dossiers in my book and living people. Only you, or say your attorney, with your permission, can write away under the Freedom of Information Act for a file. I could not, for example, write away for your file, because the files in my book, all the authors and dramatists and artists were deceased. But you yourself can write away for your own file under the Freedom of Information Act, and there you write to the Department of Justice in Washington, and wait a while and see if they have one.
And I asked the Justice Department for my FBI file?
Yeah, to see. That was your original question, whether your mail was being watched for some reason because you had written to certain groups or embassies.
These were agents of foreign powers. There wasn't anything that I thought was sensitive in any of this mail. But I wrote a letter to an acquaintance who's a Soviet emigre doctor, and he lives about 3 miles down the road from me, and he never got that one either, you know.
Yeah, well.
And this is all new. I don't think that the post office has fallen into confusion. Other letters that I send to other places don't seem to have any trouble arriving.
Well, you might ask the post office.
Well, I appreciate your telling me.
That whole thing about how you obtain files. Uh-huh. Incidentally, in my book, I do have the files of a number of living authors. John Kenneth Galbraith, a Harvard economist. Bill Malden, the famous cartoonist for the Chicago newspapers, a syndicated cartoonist, author of Up Front, Willie and Joe. These were friends of mine, and after when word got out that I was working on this subject, Bill Malden sent me his FBI file. So did John Kenneth Galbraith, and so did several others send me material from their files. But it was their files that they had obtained. As I say, I could not have received receive their files. And I think that's a very good policy, by the way, because that would invade their privacy. You can't get my file, and I can't get yours.
Yes, sir. I just write to the Justice Department?
Yeah.
I see. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Right. Let me ask you now, I'm curious, Mr. Mitgang, have you ever written to the FBI to find out whether they have a file on you?
Well, only after I finished the book. I didn't want to personalize this book because I was writing about some of the giants of American literature, a half dozen Nobel laureates, Hemingway, Faulkner, Steinbeck, Thomas Mann, Pearl Buck. And I didn't want to intrude myself into it. But after I finished the book, I did write away from my file. I'm still waiting to hear. But as a friend, as E.L. Doctorow, the author of Ragtime, he said, it'd be an honors list to be included with these giants of American literature.
Yes, I would think it would be sort of like being on those people who were on President Nixon's enemies list.
Yeah.
It's kind of
a badge of honor.
I believe in the book you mentioned that you are aware that there are files on some authors and you don't name them. Are there a number of people that you know there are files on that
you don't discuss?
Yes,
I was shown in Washington, I was shown a long, long list of names and organizations with files, but I was shown these on condition that I did not reveal the source. But I have enough in there where I do actually have the files. Many of these were living authors, as your previous caller mentioned, and so I could not get to the files on these living authors unless they sent them to me themselves. But there's an interesting question that has arisen and that I've frequently been asked since Dangerous Dossiers first published, and that is this still going on today, or is just a vestige of the bad days of Hoover and McCarthyism? The sad answer is that it is still going on today. And anyone who opposed President Reagan's and this administration's policies in Central America, anyone who went down to Nicaragua or El Salvador for legitimate reasons, to make a movie as a journalist, were fairly certain to get files open up on them. The Center for Constitutional Rights, it made up a lot of pro bono lawyers, wrote away in this respect and obtained over 1,000 pages of documents. Another 1,000 pages were withheld in their entirety, pointing out that such organizations as the United Auto Workers, film companies, and most surprising of all, the Mary Knowles sisters. Now, these nuns had gone down to El Salvador, Central America, on nursing missions and humanitarian missions. Nevertheless, they had file opened up on them, and that was in the last year.
Yeah. Something that you also mentioned in the book that people may have heard of is the FBI's efforts to recruit librarians inform on patrons. Apparently, the FBI would like the librarians to keep track of what people are reading so that then the FBI can come along and get a list of what books I went down to the local library and took out. I think the librarians are the wrong bunch to approach on this kind of thing because they're pretty fierce about these sorts of things and didn't much appreciate the FBI's request.
No. Well, that's called the Library Awareness Program of the FBI. And in 38 states plus the District of Columbia, including the state of Illinois, there are laws, confidentiality statutes, where librarians cannot be forced or not supported.
supposed to give out the names of library users and what books they take out. Now, that's not just by law as it exists in many of these states, but also by tradition. From the time as a kid you get your first proud library card, it's between you and the librarian. You don't want somebody to know what books you're taking home or what you're reading. That's a private encounter. And the Library Awareness Program, the FBI has alerted certain librarians to tell them what books are being taken out, if there are any of them have anything to do, especially in the science technology area, that might be helping Russian agents. Now, that is their reason for doing so. And this came up only last week in the testimony by the FBI itself, which tried to justify the program. However, a half dozen of the major library associations, including the American Library Association, represents about 45,000 librarians and is based in Chicago. The American Library Association is opposed to the awareness program. And that is one of the things where there's a clash in what people regard, certain people regard, as constitutional rights. Now, there's no doubt that the FBI has its own role to play. Yes, they have a role to play in trying to discover foreign agents in this country. That's the role, that's the purpose behind a library awareness program. However, as Congressman Don Edwards of California, who's chairman of the Subcommittee on Civil and Constitutional Rights, said only last week during hearings on this subject, this is excessive. This should not interfere with the librarian's right of privacy and the user's right of privacy. The FBI thinks otherwise.
Mm-hmm. We have just about 10 minutes left, maybe a couple of minutes more than that. And I just want to remind people again who are listening that we're talking with Herbert Mittgang, author of Dangerous Dossiers, a book about FBI's attempts at keeping track of some of our greatest writers. The book is recently published. And if you, if in our last 10 or so minutes here you want to be a part of the program, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. There are a couple of rather funny stories in the book, stories of ways in which the FBI showed its lack of literary acumen in keeping files on some of these people. And I wonder if you could tell the two stories. I'm thinking of one is about Nelson Algren, and yeah, one is about Galbraith, John Kenneth Galbraith.
Yes, and Nelson Algren. He's listed in his file as having an alias, or several aliases. Well, Nelson Algren, author of The Man with the Golden Arm, A Chicago City on the Make, and Somebody in Boots, wonderful writer, wonderful, funny man, great sense of humor, and a great buddy of Studs Terkel. And I've spent time with both of them while Nelson was still alive. Nelson, of course, was having a well-known affair with Simone de Beauvoir, and the existentialist, and Nelson listed in the Gary, Indiana telephone directory that his name was Simon Beauvoir. Simon Beauvoir. Well, this caused great consternation and suspicion by the FBI, unaware of their relationship. And I checked the Gary, Indiana phone directory, thanks librarian there, and the same directory did not have the name Nelson Algren, but it was his phone number where I used to reach him. And so finally I wrote away the FBI and said, don't you know the reason behind these aliases. You've got Simon de Beauvoir, Simone Beauvoir. They had three of them, and they would not answer because that might have been embarrassing.
Okay, that's a great story.
The other one was has to do with a certain Dr. Weir. The FBI had once heard a description of John Kenneth Galbraith's work as being doctrinaire. And so they had heard it wrongly, and so they went looking for a Dr. Weir, W-A-R-E, thinking that this was some kind of a economic terrorist. They never could find Dr. Weir.
The evil Dr. Weir.
The evil Dr. Weir.
Yeah. Galbraith seems to think that that's pretty funny.
Well, Galbraith is the one who may have more seriously said, on me alone, the FBI in order to have a file and track him in a half dozen cities. And, of course, he's a Canadian, so that, for some reason, made him a suspicious character as well. As well as the fact that his books, The Affluent Society, and so on, may not have pleased J. Edgar Hoover's and the FBI's concept of a true Americanism.
Mm-hmm.
Galbraith told me, on him alone, the FBI must have expended hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, you multiply that by many other people, and you can see tens of millions of dollars of wasted manpower and wasted taxpayer treasure.
All that time that they could have been pursuing real criminals.
Yes, they were organized crime.
Spending their time on these people who did nothing more than perhaps rouse the ire of Mr. Hoover or some other people.
Oh, they roused them all right. People like Rex Stout once wrote one of his novels in which there was an FBI agent portrayed not in a libertarian light. And someone like Carl Sandburg, as well as Ernest Hemingway, both made cracks against the FBI. And Bill Mauldin, he wasn't doing cartoons which talked about the great J. Edgar Hoover by any means. In fact, in Bill Mauldin's file, the FBI was actually clipped his cartoons because he took a couple of cracks against the House on American Activities Committee for their snooping against creative people instead of chasing real criminals.
Yeah. I guess, too, one of the people that you talk about in the book, one of the living writers is Norman Mailer, and apparently the FBI was rather upset by a crack that he took at Hoover when he was doing Irv Kupcinet's old TV show in Chicago. He said, J. Edgar Hoover has paralyzed the imagination of this country in a way Joseph Stalin never could, and that there was a great number of the pages in Mailer's file that were devoted just to this one appearance on this television program.
Well, I think Mailer exaggerated. I think Stalin was a little worse. A hell of a lot worse, as in fact today's newspaper reports that they're finally going to, somebody's doing a biography of Stalin. But the broad influence of J. Edgar Hoover, and now I'm not citing myself, but I'm citing some of his own aides and a new biography called The Boss. It was, as far as violations United States Constitution, the First Amendment, especially the Fourth Amendment, saying that people shall be secure against violations by government in their houses and papers. Very important amendment, that Fourth Amendment. J. Edgar Hoover constantly violated those amendments.
Well, as a result of people reading this book, what is it that you will hope will happen? What you know, other than documenting these this specific program, these files on these writers, what is it that you would like people to come away with from?
Well, I hope that first of all, this would show that the right of privacy is a constitutional right. The Fourth Amendment that I mentioned a moment ago is right there in the Constitution, that the government has no right to keep files on individuals. And I'm not talking just about authors and playwrights and artists. I'm talking about citizens. Furthermore, that the only way you can, a police agency, federal, state, or local, should be able to intrude on people's lives is first by obtaining court orders. You just cannot wiretap and bug people, watch their mail, take down their license plate numbers, look at what petitions they sign, without having some court order alleging that there's a possible crime being committed or planned. Furthermore, this book is, I hope this book will cause biographers to examine and make use of the Freedom of Information Act, as I have, because a lot of these biographies, I think, will have to have a second look as a result of the information that I have unearthed under the Freedom of Information Act on major American writers. It may shed some light on them, and especially their relationship to the government. The above all, I want to reveal the fact that there is, on occasion, and in certain quarters of the United States government, an anti-intellectual tone, an anti-university tone. You remember the great governor of Illinois, Adlai Stevenson, was called an egghead by people like McCarthy, by people like Richard Nixon. An egghead was a word of opprobrium. What they were saying is, he's an intellectual. This man has the nerve to read books. This man has the nerve to quote the Constitution and history. He's talking over our heads. What right has he got to be an egghead? What right has he got to use his mind? So this is the kind of anti-intellectualism that exists in certain quarters of the government. You know, it's been said Ronald Reagan that he owns more tuxedos than books. And let's hope that in those areas where government intersects with our lives, in grants to libraries, in grants to universities, in grants on the National Endowment for the Humanities, National Endowment for the Arts, to institutions, that this anti-intellectualism that was at the heart of these dossiers is exposed, and that these efforts will be diminished.
Well, there we will have to leave it. It's a very interesting book, and I appreciate you giving us some of your time today to talk about it. Herbert Mittgang, our guest, and once again, the book that we have been talking about is Dangerous Dossiers, Exposing the Secret War Against America's Greatest Authors. It's recently published by Donald Fine.